Today is Thursday, October 26th. We're going to wrap up the digestive system today. So I'm going to go back and review some stuff that we were talking about in here on Tuesday's class from page 91. During the last few minutes of class, we were getting ready to talk about how to have a poop. So an appropriate topic for us to have the doors open so the hallway can hear, right?
Yes.
So in order to have a bowel movement or to have a defecation reflex, produce a bowel movement, there are some things that lead up to the process. And one of those things is something called a hostral contraction. And if we go back and look at our big picture of the large intestine, those hostra are little pockets, little folds there, created by the band of Tania coli muscle. So what does a hostral contraction actually accomplish?
It moves fecal matter from one hostra to the next hostra.
Yeah, feces or fecal matter, one hostra to the next hostra. That's about every 30 seconds or so, so we're not going to accomplish a whole lot just by moving feces literally next door. Now, if you want to have something actually move, then you need what's called a mass reflex or mass movement. This involves eating, and it better occurs if you have something warm in your diet, like a hot cup of coffee, which I don't know today, that sounds in this hot room, right? But if you have something warm hit your stomach, that can encourage a mass movement.
That explains so much.
Hot, not cold?
Yes.
Yeah.
Me and my sister, every single time in the morning,
take something warm, that'll do it. Yep. So the stomach actually is going to start the mass movement, and that wave of peristalsis sweeps over both your stomach and your large intestine. The goal is to propel feces toward the rectum. Okay, so I don't know if you got that blank on Tuesday, but the mass movement's function is to propel feces toward the rectum. So that means that normally your rectum is empty, there's no feces in there, and you may have several mass movements a day, and none of them may accomplish moving feces towards your rectum. But once your rectum stretches with feces, then now we feel an urge to have a bowel movement. So, some people may in fact feel and stretch the rectum 3 or 4 times a day, and they may have a bowel movement that often. But, they say that what is normal for you may not be normal for somebody else. So somebody may have 3 to 4 bowel movements a day. Somebody else may have 3 to 4 bowel movements a week. So it just depends on how your body operates and what it considers to be the average set. Ashley.
I have a clear question.
Okay.
What are chemicals that cause you to have gas? What breakdowns?
They say it is vitamin-rich food.
Fibers,
yeah. Beans are great sources of vitamins.
No, like what in the small intestine, what enzymes or whatever causes that?
It is probably some type of, guessing like amylase, maybe some types of sugar breakdown enzymes that are doing it. Just guessing. And it's the bacteria that facilitate that enzymatic reaction to help extract the vitamins out of that food. But it depends on what you've got in there in terms of what kind of food compounds. It doesn't seem to be the case with proteins or fats. It seems to be more the case, like you say, with fibers and carbs. Yeah.
So it's like the breakdown of that is causing the gas.
Yeah, the methane, yeah.
We're like cows.
We are like cows. So the parasympathetic nervous system is the one that controls our rest and digest state. You've got to be in parasympathetic mode in order for your bowels to move. And the relay that happens here occurs between your rectum, your anal sphincters, and your brain. You consciously keep shut one of your anal sphincters. Going back and looking at the picture here, which anal sphincter are we able to consciously keep closed?
The skeletal.
The skeletal muscle, yeah, that external anal sphincter. The internal anal sphincter is actually made up of
a smooth muscle.
So when you've got a full rectum, it's full of feces, the internal anal sphincter opens. There are nerves sitting down here at the very bottom part of your spinal cord called splanchnic nerves, And they travel with information up to your brain that says, hey, there's pressure in your rectum, the internal anal sphincter is open, and then of course you must now make the decision whether or not you want to open the external anal sphincter. And if the timing is right, you send down a message, you relax the external anal sphincter, and a bowel movement may be produced. Now, we actually do what's called the Valsalva's maneuver during a bowel movement. What is that? The Valsalva's maneuver, what is that? Pushing, yeah. So if you hold your breath and you push, that's the Valsalva's maneuver. You're using the pressure in your abdomen to help push out the feces. And by holding your breath, you're creating pressure that helps to force the feces out. So we actually do that during a bowel movement. You may not realize you're doing it, but nonetheless, we hold our breath and push when we're having a bowel movement to expel the feces.
Wasn't that in the nerve that you said? Do we need to know?
Don't worry about the flanchant nerve, yeah.
Okay. What was that?
It's a Valsalva's maneuver. It's Valsalva. And it's actually back in the respiratory system notes when we talked about vocal cords. We perform that maneuver by closing our vocal cords and then creating pressure in our thoracic cavity that helps to force out fecal content. So we've talked about it as a vagal maneuver before, same thing. Now, if the timing is not right and you decide that you do not want to open the anal sphincters, then your brain will tell the spinal cord to tell the splanchnic nerves to keep that external anal sphincter shut. And so it takes some time for the message to travel back down the spinal cord. It takes time for those external anal sphincter muscles to relax. So a few moments later, you'll eventually feel a moment of relaxation. Give it about 3 to 5 minutes, and the message comes back up to the brain again that, hey, you know, we're still waiting. There's still feces in the rectum, and you've got to make a decision. So this relay back and forth between the rectum, anal sphincters, and the brain will continue until you either are going to have a bowel movement, whether or not you will it. So, you know, sometimes if there's enough pressure there, we cannot control keeping those external sphincters closed. Since we're in the neighborhood of talking about large intestine, I did want to go back and mention that if we're looking for bowel sounds, you know, a stethoscope can be used to listen for sounds of rumbling and gases gurgling through your intestines. If we can hear bowel sounds, that's good news, especially if someone's had surgery, because that means the conveyor belt of peristalsis is back in action. The bad news is, if someone's had surgery, these intestines are a little sensitive to being touched or manipulated, and so it may take several days for them to work back up into their peristalsis waves once again. Do you want to feed somebody solid food who does not have waves of peristalsis? Because what could happen to all that food? Back it up. Yeah, so it gets locked in the intestines, and the person may become very constipated if those bowels are not producing waves of peristalsis. Since we're also in the neighborhood, I wanted to mention as a side note to you this. You know, back in Bio 2.10, we talked about acetylcholine. Okay, so what is acetylcholine?
Neurotransmitter.
Neurotransmitter, good. And during our rest and digest state parasympathetic control, we know acetylcholine is going to make our digestive organs go through waves of peristalsis. Now, if you take a drug that blocks the release of acetylcholine, what do you think happens to your waves of peristalsis?
Slow it down.
And now what are you more at risk for? Back it up, constipation, right? So a lot of medications actually have anticholinergic effects. Benadryl is one, our favorite drug, right? Puts you to sleep, you're completely unconscious, okay? So a lot of drugs like that basically tell the intestines and the digestive tract to slow down their activities. Urination also slows when we experience anticholinergic medications like Benadryl. There's a whole bunch of them on the market. But that's one that we're probably most familiar with. So I just want to mention that, you know, some medications induce constipation, and that's how they block acetylcholine from telling those intestines to keep things moving.
So is that the same like pain medication, or is pain medication dehydrating?
Pain medication is also anticholinergic for the most part, and so, yeah, that's where the constipation comes in. Opioid-based pain medications are especially anticholinergic. no fun there. Okay, so that should wrap us up down there near near almost the bottom of page 91. Let me hit for you a couple of those disorders. Okay, so we've got diarrhea and constipation. All they do is tell us that either the feces move too quickly and cause diarrhea, not giving us an opportunity to absorb what? Fluids and water, yeah. And if a person has constipation, we're looking at the opposite issue. Instead of moving too quickly, the feces sit too long in the digestive tract. And what are we absorbing out of those feces?
All the water.
All the water, yeah, so it dries out the feces. So, you know, we're looking at basically two ends of the spectrum there for how fast the feces move through the digestive tract. I want to show you diverticulitis, though, because this one's a pretty nasty-looking disorder, especially when you see the lining of the digestive tract. This is a very good reason not to push really hard when you have a bowel movement, because pressure can cause blowouts along the large intestine. You're looking here at a diverticulum. That's this blowout here. And each of these caverns here are a little diverticulum that have been basically blown out of the wall of your large intestine. And unfortunately, feces can get trapped in there and infection can occur. And that's pus sitting there on top of each of those diverticulum. Now, certain foods can also get trapped in those diverticulum. What are some foods that people are supposed to avoid if they've got this problem?
Spicy.
Yes, spicy foods.
Anything with seeds.
Rice, yeah. Nuts, you know, grains that can get stuck in there. So, yeah, we don't want to necessarily aggravate the condition with spicy foods and little tiny pieces of hard food matter that can get trapped in that area. These are diverticulum here. These are like blowouts of the large intestine. And you can really see here, these are not normal. You should not see these blowouts along the length. And these are not diamond rings. These are diverticulum full of feces.
So is that the same as like a hernia, like someone has a hernia in their intestine? Is it like just a really big one? Or?
Actually, a hernia would be a piece of the intestine that gets into the muscle wall, and it can actually kink off and cause a part of your intestines to die. Mm. So, or it can create a blockage so that the food or feces cannot move further on beyond that point. So it's actually a little different from this. There's oftentimes like incisional hernias where people have a piece of their intestine poke into the incision. Males often have inguinal hernias where the intestines poke into the inguinal canal. So there's cases there where you've got basically the risk of having gangrene and death of your intestines. Yeah, yeah. We're very lucky to have modern surgery.
My mom has a hernia that's a softball.
Ooh. Yeah. Yeah, because if that gets pinched off and the piece dies, then you got real problems.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Another good reason not to force bowel movements is hemorrhoids. And these are failed veins. Basically, the valves in the veins can no longer keep the blood from backflowing. So these are failed varicose veins. You know, we've got backflow and pooling of blood in these veins. If the vein is internal, then we don't necessarily see it from the outside. External hemorrhoids are ones that are on the outer surface of the anus. Nonetheless, they can both bleed when a bowel movement is passed by this area. And I know most of you don't want to look at this, but you know, this is what external hemorrhoids can look like. So pretty gnarly looking picture there. All right. So why don't we look at something a little prettier than hemorrhoids? And we'll turn the page over and talk about pancreas, gallbladder, and liver. Yeah, what a great picture to walk in for, Jarrett, you know? Hemorrhoids. Let's look at something a little prettier. All right, so we have completed the tour of major digestive organs. We're going to instead now focus on accessory organs. So what is the difference? Why do we consider the pancreas accessory and not major?
Because it doesn't directly digest food or touch food.
Good, good. Doesn't directly touch food. It secretes things for digestion, but you're right. Food doesn't necessarily come in contact with the pancreas, liver, gallbladder. Even salivary glands, you know, teeth and tongue are considered to be accessory. Let's talk about the pancreas first. This organ is a triangular-shaped organ that's sitting behind the stomach. It is wedged into the peritoneum, that visceral mesentery that wraps around your digestive organs. And we consider it to be both an endocrine gland and an exocrine gland. In terms of its endocrine function, endocrine mean it releases what?
Hormones.
Hormones, yeah. And those hormones are insulin and glucagon. That's it, insulin and glucagon. So I gave you a blank there to jot those down. This is a reminder. Those pancreatic islet cells release insulin and glucagon. Those pancreatic islet cells release insulin and glucagon. We've talked about the islet cells and insulin and glucagon a little bit back with our endocrine system. Let's focus this time on talking about the exocrine function of your pancreas. And just to start with, what does exo tell us?
Outer.
Outer, yes. Yeah. So we're releasing substances that will eventually end up in the outside world. And the main job here is for the pancreas to release two kinds of fluids from Acini cells. So you're looking here at Acini cells, separate type of cell from those islet cells. These Acini cells release digestive fluids that go into the small intestine. Let's talk about those digestive fluids released by your Acini cells. There's two types of fluids released by your pancreas. One is an enzyme-rich set of juices. So what do enzymes assist with?
Breakdown.
Yeah, so in our digestive tract, they are helping us to break down food particles. And we've got several listed here that may be familiar. We have pancreatic amylase. We know ASE is an enzyme. What specifically is it breaking down?
Starch
into sugars. Good. Helps us break down starch into sugars. Now, they emphasize that it's called pancreatic amylase because there is another amylase produced where?
In your mouth,
right. And so we call it salivary amylase in your mouth to distinguish the difference between pancreatic amylase coming from your pancreas. We've also got pancreatic lipase. What does that help us break down?
Fatty acids.
Fatty acids, good. This is a great time for us to review. Lipase works as part of a tag team. There is another kind of chemical that helps us to emulsify big fats into smaller, more manageable pieces. That chemical is
bile.
Good. Lipase relies on bile doing its job because lipase needs smaller, more manageable fatty molecules to break apart into their building blocks.
So what are the two blanks?
What are the two blanks? What are the building blocks of fats? You got it. Fatty acid and glycerol. Good. Lipase helps us to break down fats into fatty acids and glycerol. Let's see. Starches break down into sugars. Good, yeah. Starches break down into sugars. Okay, and then finally, trypsin and chymotrypsin. Hey, there's those syn words, right? Break down proteins. Good. And what are the building blocks of proteins?
Amino acids.
Amino acids. Good. So the small intestine does produce some of its own enzymes, but we are assisted by having these enzymes come from your pancreas into your small intestine. So what kinds of food groups do we break down in your small intestine? So could we say everything and be right? Yeah.
Yeah.
we use both small intestine enzymes and pancreatic enzymes to help break down those food groups in the small intestine. All right, so the second component of pancreatic juice is something called a bicarbonate-rich fluid. Now, bicarbonate here is going to behave as a base, so bicarbonate is an alkaline substance. Let's kind of go back and hit some old material. The stomach releases hydrochloric acid. That hydrochloric acid makes the pH in your stomach around what?
1 and 2.
1 and 2, good. We know blood pH has, say, 7.35 to 7.45, and if you absorb stomach acid directly into the bloodstream, what could happen to your blood pH? Acidosis, yeah.
Not a good sign.
Not a good sign, right. So we want to not mix those two chemicals. You don't want a pH of 1 coming into blood with a pH of 7. So the pancreas releases this alkaline bicarbonate fluid. This fluid helps to raise the secretions in your stomach, or the food in your stomach, rather, up to around a 7.4 pH. Now, if you absorb, say, a pH of 7.4 into your bloodstream, is there a big yo-yo effect for your blood pH? No. So we're going to ensure that we are, they call it isotonic, but that makes me think more of osmosis. But nonetheless, in terms of pH, we're isotonic to what blood pH is going to be. Okay. So on your bottom down there, you've got a couple of questions to look at. Why is it important for chyme in the small intestine to be closer to 7? Yeah, keep it close to blood pH. Good, so we want to keep that pH closer to blood pH. Okay, so last review. The pancreas is both an endocrine and an exocrine organ. In terms of its endocrine function, it releases two hormones, insulin and glucagon. In terms of its exocrine function, it releases two juices. One type of juice contains enzymes. The other juice is a more alkaline bicarbonate-rich fluid. Which of those two juices is meant to neutralize stomach acid? Yeah, that alkaline bicarbonate-rich fluid, good. The other type, the enzyme-rich juice, is meant to help do what to our foods in the small intestine?
Yep.
Break them down. Break down sugars, break down fats, break down proteins. Okay, and so the number one function for your small intestine is to do what with those nutrients? Break them down and absorb them, right. So the small intestine by itself is doing what it can, but we've got extra help coming in from this pancreas. Okay, so let's think about this. You can see the relationship here between the pancreas and the small intestine. You know, if food comes into the small intestine, how does this pancreas know that there's food present there? Increase in sugar. Yeah, there could be something like sugar that's now entering the bloodstream. So if we want to tell the pancreas, hey, we've got food coming in, now's the time for you to send your enzymes, now's the time for you to send your bicarbonate-rich fluids, pancreas is just sitting there. It has, you know, no direct contact with the food traveling through. So we can use something that travels through the bloodstream and targets the pancreas. What would that be?
A hormone.
Good. So who do you think releases the hormone that eventually tells the pancreas to release fluids?
The duodenum.
The duodenum, yeah. So the duodenum is saying, hey, pancreas, I've got food in me. Now's the time for you to release your fluids into the small intestine. Excuse me. So let's take a look. We've got a couple of things going on here. We've got a main pancreatic duct joins the common bile duct. Together they make a hepatopancreatic ampulla, and that little papilla inside the small intestine is where that little tip of those two tubes joins inside the small intestine. Major duodenal papilla, good. And then you've got this accessory duct, and it branches off, and again, you've got a little tip there inside the small intestine, The minor duodenal papilla, you can see where that little tube pokes into the lining. So if you release juices from the pancreas into the small intestine, those juices can travel from the main or the accessory duct and make their way here into the small intestine. So when do you want to secrete these fluids from the pancreas? When your intestines are empty or when they're full of food?
Full of food.
Full of food, good. So the way that we tell the pancreas that we've got food and we're ready for those juices to come is we send a hormone through the bloodstream to target the pancreas. So now the guesswork is, how do we know, or how does the duodenum know that it should release hormones? What happens to the diameter of your pancreas, or your small intestine rather, when you're filling up with food? It stretches, right? That stretching of your small intestine is what will trigger the release of some hormones from your small intestine. Those hormones are going to travel through the bloodstream and target the pancreas. And the message for the pancreas is, hey, food's here, okay? And now it's time for you to secrete your juices. So I'm kind of getting you prepared for what's on the top of the next page. Top of page 93 has secretin and CCK. I promised you on Tuesday that I'd come back and talk about CCK. CCK not only tells your stomach to slow down its activities, but it also tells your pancreas to release some juice. Okay, so notice that both secretin and CCK are made by your duodenum. Okay, so that's one thing to appreciate. Secretin and CCK are hormones. They're both made by your duodenum. Let's take secretin first. Secretin kind of sounds like secretion, doesn't it? Okay, and you'll notice that if you read along there, this particular hormone is triggered to be released from your duodenum when you have hydrochloric acid in your small intestine. All right, so that kind of gives me a clue, because if we've got acid coming into our small intestine, we want to neutralize that acid. We've got two kinds of fluids released by your pancreas. We've got enzyme-rich and bicarbonate-rich. Which one of those two will neutralize acid?
Bicarbonate-rich.
Yeah, bicarbonate-rich. So secretin travels from your duodenum through the bloodstream, comes full circle over here to your pancreas, and tells your pancreas it's time to release that bicarbonate-rich fluid. In turn, those acini-cells make the fluid. It travels through either the main pancreatic duct or the accessory duct, and that fluid is ejected here into the duodenum. And then, of course, we neutralize that chyme. We bring the pH now in your small intestine from around 1 up to closer to what?
7.
About 7, yeah. So that's better for absorbing into the bloodstream than, say, some acid that's 1 or 2. Notice that secretin not only talks to your pancreas, it has a second target organ. What is that other organ?
The liver.
Yep. So the secretin hormone also travels the bloodstream. It travels to the liver, which actually is not pictured in this image. But the liver now releases a chemical that will help to emulsify fats. Bile. Good. Bile comes from these hepatic ducts, down the common hepatic, continues down the common bile, and down here into the duodenum. So we actually begin the emulsification of fats when secretin tells the liver it's time to release bile. Okay, so that's one hormone that's going to target the pancreas. Notice the name of the second one is CCK, but let's break down the word because I think that can be helpful to remember. The big word there is cholecystokinin. Do you recall what C-H-O-L-E, col, stands for?
Bile.
Bile, good, okay. And how about a cyst? That's a good way to think about it. Yes, cystic duct, which is another name for the bladder, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then kinin means to move. So there's a lot of hidden gems in that word. Col is bile. Cyst, yeah, think of cystic duct, think of the gallbladder. And kynon means to move or contract. So what organ produces CCK?
The duodenum.
Yeah. And once again, when food enters the duodenum, it's going to release CCK and secretin, but this time it specifically is going to respond to fats and proteins in the food coming into your small intestine. How does CCK travel to its target organs?
Through the
bloodstream. Good. And what are the two target organs of CCK?
Pancreas and gallbladder.
Good. In response to the presence of CCK, let's take the gallbladder first. It contracts and releases
bile.
Good. We travel first through our cystic duct, next through which one?
The common bile duct.
And then we join with the main pancreatic duct, and that bile is dumped into your duodenum. Mm-hmm. Once there, what does bile do to the foods that are present?
It breaks it down.
And what specific food group?
The fats.
Good.
I was going to ask, what makes pancreatic cancer like the worst kind of cancer?
It affects epithelial cells inside the pancreas. It has very little symptoms, so people don't actually feel pain. They don't feel anything. It progresses from a stage one, then it becomes a metastasized cancer and spreads to like maybe nearby organs. And
it's not so much that it's affecting the pancreas, it's that by the time you catch it, it's affected other stuff.
Yes. Yeah.
My husband's best friend has type 1 diabetes, and he's like insulin dependent, and I was like, can you get your pancreas taken out? But I guess since you need the juices and stuff that come from it,
yeah.
I'm assuming his is not like messed up in that case, it's just like insulin and the other food could be on.
Yeah, his islet cells don't work, but his Acini cells do work.
Okay.
And they can take out, if they catch pancreatic cancer early enough, they can take out a portion of the pancreas and leave the healthy part intact. Yeah. But yeah, it's basically, there's not a good detection mechanism. Just like ovarian cancer has a poor, you know, poor rate to it, but survival rate, because it's hard to catch.
Is there something, like, I know pancreatic cancer is common in men and women. Is there a reason for that?
It may be genetic, it may be hormonal, it may be stress, environmental. So, yeah. But if somebody can develop a test that can catch it early for early diagnosis, then we'll probably see dramatic survival rates improve from that.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go back and do CCK from the top. Where is CCK made?
In the duodenum.
Duodenum, good. What will trigger its release?
Fats and proteins.
Good. Fats and proteins coming from the stomach. And once those fats and proteins are in the duodenum, that triggers the release of CCK. What are the two target organs of CCK?
The pancreas.
Good. And when pancreas receives the message from CCK, it releases?
Enzyme-rich juices.
Good. Enzyme-rich juices. They travel either through the main or accessory pancreatic duct. Those juices now come into the duodenum. And what do those enzymes help us break down or hydrolyze? Fats, proteins, even starches. Yeah, so going back to that list there, amylase, yeah, lipase, trypsin, and chymotrypsin. We know that the gallbladder will contract in response to CCK, and the contraction of the gallbladder sends what product down into the small intestine?
Bile.
Good.
So the enzyme-rich pancreatic juice is like everything, and bile is just breakdown of fat.
Yeah.
It's the result of the bile.
It's the result of what? Oh, two totally different things. Yeah, the bile is just for the emulsification of the fats, and that lipase coming from the pancreas helps to break them down through hydrolysis. Is that kind of what you're...
Yeah.
Okay.
So bile don't break down proteins?
Bile doesn't break down proteins. It just emulsifies fats. So this is kind of a trick to keep it straight, because we're talking about a circle of conversation. It's like ringing your neighbor next door and having them ring somebody to call you back. You know, it's just kind of a circle of a conversation. So it's getting that conversation straight. the conversation in our case here begins with the duodenum releasing hormones. Those hormones are CCK and secretin. What are the two targets of secretin?
Liver and pancreas.
Liver and pancreas. And the two targets of CCK?
Gallbladder
and pancreas. Good. Ultimately, what the pancreas, liver, and gallbladder secrete ends back up where?
In the duodenum.
Yeah, so you basically come full circle. It's like ringing their bells and saying, hey, pancreas, gallbladder, and liver, I've got food. Send me your secretions. And here comes the secretion down into the duodenum for digestion. So that's kind of how this is operating using these hormones.
That makes sense why it looks all connected like that together.
Why it's all sitting.
We just know the flow of bile, but we're not told as to what it does until we get here. And now it makes sense.
That's good. Kind of comes full circle.
Mm-hmm.
Ashley.
So if you don't have a gallbladder anymore, does CCK just target the pancreas? Or does it travel somewhere else to release bile?
Is it in the liver?
Or targeting, you know?
It targets the stomach and tells it to slow down its intestinal phase. So it actually makes the stomach slow down its secretion of gastric juices.
Right.
But yeah, since there's no more gallbladder, there's really nothing there for it to target in terms of bile secretion. Bile secretion comes from secretin from the liver. So a lot of these hormones have many other functions that we don't cover in here.
Explain why, like, if you have your gallbladder removed, like, your liver takes the place of your gallbladder whenever it's removed.
Basically,
right?
Yeah.
So, what causes, like, you to be super sensitive to, like, fatty foods when you have it removed?
When you are not digesting, you know, you've got this backwards track here, you can actually take some of the bile, back it up here into the gallbladder, dehydrate it, and store it in a concentrated form. So that when food hits the duodenum, it's like boom, you've got like a backup supply of bile coming from the gallbladder and the liver. But without a gallbladder, then you're only having to rely on the liver to secrete as fast as it can. And so all that fat in the small intestine can cause a dumping syndrome, and then the person has diarrhea because the bile is not there to emulsify the fats. What's that? Yeah, because your liver's it's a one-man show at that point.
Oh, okay. Because that's storing bile, and then it's
yeah.
just coming back down, but whatever it comes from the liver is going directly there.
Okay. Correct, yeah.
That was another thing I was thinking about with the other surgery, the stomach surgery, the, I think it's the bypass one.
Uh-huh.
They take out your duodenum. Like, they literally cut it and make it useless. So what is there to secrete the CCK in? Like, does it come from the rest part, like maybe the jejunum and the ileum?
I don't think that part makes CCK and secretin, and if they do, it's probably in a very reduced amount.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, then you're right, you're talking about affecting fat digestion and all those nutrients and everything. Yeah.
I would explain why the main thing about it is the dumping syndrome. That was one of the main effects that you get from that, rather than the one that I get, because they don't have to take out or cut off any part of the small intestine.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas part, and it looks like they cut off that whole duodenum and make it useless.
Which seems, it just would make the whole process very dangerous, you would think, to cut off that. That is your primary point for absorption, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind all this communication back and forth here. Yeah. All right. Do you have any questions so far? Anything from pages 92 or 93? I know you guys, we were talking about how to study this stuff when class started. I wouldn't flashcard CCK and secretin. I'd talk it, till you get that story straight. You know, who's the target? How do you get it released? What is released in response to their presence at the liver, gallbladder, pancreas? That's just a story that's going to be kind of tricky to get straight in your mind. Let's see, we've got the liver next. It's over on the top of page 94. Interesting organ. It's our largest digestive organ. It's also an organ that can regenerate. So kind of cool, if you have a damaged liver, you can take off the damaged part And if you have enough healthy liver liver tissue intact, it can regenerate new tissue.
Is that why you can donate portions of your liver?
That's exactly right, yeah. So a pretty cool organ. It's a very resilient organ, and it takes a lot of abuse from what we do to it, you know, throughout a lifetime. But nonetheless, it can have problems if we do abuse it over a lifetime with things like medications.
So if you have cirrhosis of the liver, could you, like, reverse that at that point or not?
Probably not, because it affects the entirety of the liver, and there's probably little healthy tissue left to regenerate. I know from lab you guys are already familiar with liver structure. You've got a right lobe that is fairly large.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a little smaller left lobe, and on the back side a caudate and quadrate lobe.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a falciform ligament that separates the right and the left lobe right through here. I wanted to mention why that falciform ligament should actually tell a familiar story. When we are fetuses before we're born, there's a set of umbilical arteries and veins that travels through the liver. And those vessels hook up with your IVC and your aorta. And the cool thing is, once we're born, you know, our umbilical cord is cut, and we no longer need these vessels giving us oxygen and taking away, you know, waste products. So those vessels spasm shut, and what's left behind is that falciform ligament. So kind of cool that that's actually a remnant of fetal circulation before we're born. Physiological, yeah. If you have jaundice as a baby, what's happened is you haven't had your first bowel movement, and one of these ducts here coming from the gallbladder or liver has a plug in it. And once you have your first bowel movement as a baby, the plug undoes, and then the bile goes out into the feces instead of into the bloodstream.
The liver is like the last thing to mature, right?
One of the last, yeah. That and lungs are pretty late, yeah. And once babies have their bowel movement, then we should not have any further jaundicing. Let's see, inside the liver we have liver lobules and little hepatocyte cells. Let me show you a picture of those. These hepatocytes are nothing more than liver cells, and they're going to be storing items in the liver. So they are arranged in a pattern, kind of like a spokes of a wheel, like a bicycle wheel, around veins in the center. And you'll notice that there are blood vessels that run through these hepatocytes, giving those hepatocytes an opportunity to remove everything from good stuff like sugar to bad stuff like medications. And so those hepatocytes are basically cleansing the blood as it travels through the liver's sinusoids. That takes us to our next topic, which is hepatic portal circulation. Okay, so the word hepatic means what?
Liver.
Okay. And a portal circuit is a specialized circulation. Normally, if we talk about arteries, arterioles, capillaries, venules to veins, most of our systemic veins dump into what set of large cavernous veins? Bingo, SVC and IVC. Good. So this hepatic portal circulation is a little unique in that we take a bypass or a detour through the liver before we finally end up rejoining back with the IVC. So our story to the liver begins in the small intestine. What major activity involving nutrients occurs here?
Absorption.
Good. So we absorb nutrients through the lining of our small intestine. We pick up those nutrients and capillaries inside each of these villi. And like capillaries do, they join with venules. Venules join to make veins. All right, and so there are a set of major veins that draw blood from away from the intestines. You'll notice we've got an inferior mesenteric vein down here that pulls from actually a portion of the large intestine. We have a superior mesenteric vein, also draws from small and large intestine. Those are the two main ones we're going to focus on, but I'll just mention that the splenic vein and pancreatic veins also join together to make this big hepatic portal vein. All right, and so this hepatic portal vein is going to take blood not to the IVC, but instead to the liver. Okay, so one thing to make note of on your worksheet, hepatic portal vein takes blood to the liver. Not to the IVC, hepatic portal vein takes blood to the liver. Yep, not to the IVC, takes blood to the liver. before we get into the inside of the liver, let me just show you this. Coming off the top side of the liver, these are hepatic veins, and they're the ones that take the blood directly to the inferior vena cava. So the hepatic veins take blood to the IVC. Okay, hepatic veins take blood to the IVC. Just a little detail there to take note of. Okay, so this is a great time for us to kind of tie up some things that we've learned before. Insulin and glucagon, they are made where? Good. They control blood levels of glucose. Good. If you've got high blood glucose levels, which one will lower your blood glucose?
Insulin.
By turning glucose into a polysaccharide known as? This is digging way back. Glycogen. Okay.
I completely forgot.
Way back. Yeah, by 210 back, right?
Yeah.
So insulin takes glucose, stores it as glycogen, and the two primary storage locations for glycogen are the liver and your muscles. Okay? So that's what we're doing now, is we're kind of coming full circle. We know that glycogen is stored in your liver when extra glucose is present, and insulin helps transform that glucose into glycogen. Okay, so that's one thing we're going to look at taking place here. Other things we're going to look at are things like storage of fats, medications are filtered here, you know, good medications, bad medications, all that stuff. Anything you take by mouth is going to be filtered through your liver. Poor liver. Yeah, very much poor liver. This is a little cleaner picture. You'll notice here we have superior mesenteric vein. Over here is inferior mesenteric vein. They join with other veins coming from the stomach, the spleen, the pancreas, and together all of those veins join to make a hepatic portal vein. That hepatic portal vein comes into the liver with very nutrient-rich blood. So, just to kind of take you back a step, the hepatic portal vein is what's bringing blood into the liver. Right there is your hepatic portal vein, right? Okay, and it's going to branch numerous times, and it's going to spread out among your liver tissue. And it's set up in your liver to feed into these little spokes that look kind of like a bicycle wheel. And we actually have blood flowing from the hepatic portal vein through these cavities called sinusoids over here to a central vein. So let me just kind of give you an idea of how that looks. We'll just think about a bicycle tire for just a moment. Bicycle tire, right? Spokes in the middle. Okay. Looks like a bike, right? The vessel in the center is called a central vein. Well, that makes sense, right? It's in the center. It's called our central vein. And there are branches of your hepatic portal vein that actually feed into that central vein. So the blood is going to flow from your hepatic portal vein towards your central vein. It's hard to read and look at a picture like that, but that's the basic setup, yeah.
Like I'm taking everything from lab and I'm applying it here, and like that's why it flows.
That's how it flows that way, yeah. Do y'all need lights on? Can you see that okay? Okay, let me get the lights on for you. So that central vein in the middle is going to receive blood that comes from your hepatic portal veins. They pop up at the edges of your bike wheel, and that blood always flows kind of like a drain toward the center into that central vein. travel from those hepatic portal vein branches toward the central vein in the middle, you're traveling through cells called hepatocytes, and that blood pathway is actually called a sinusoid. So Brett got it drawn there. It says blood flow. These are sinusoids that we're traveling through. So imagine if you had a sponge and the blood flowed to the middle. That's what this is. The blood simply flows to the center of that sponge, and that sponge is going to take out waste products. It's going to take out toxins. We can store glucose as glycogen when insulin is present. So it's an opportunity for the liver to take out and remove good stuff like sugars, bad stuff like toxins, waste products, even medications and alcohol get filtered this way, and they can become stored in this spongy tissue around the liver. These are hepatocyte cells that take out and store these items. Now, some stuff is meant to be temporarily stored, like sugar. You know, if you need the blood sugar, you can come here and get it back out. But other stuff we can't really get rid of, like heavy metals. That's why lead poisoning, arsenic poisoning, any of those heavy metals, mercury, those heavy metals get trapped in these hepatocytes, and they can accumulate the toxic levels. And that's why things like heavy metal poisoning can kill us. It starts with the liver.
But if you were exposed as a child to the lead paint or whatever, so obviously you probably have some of that in there. As long as you aren't continuing to get more in, it really should never affect you, or could it possibly at some point affect you?
They say it affects, with lead specifically, they say it affects your central nervous system development. So I guess as long as you're under whatever the toxicity level is as a kid, then you probably would be okay. If you hit that toxicity level as a kid and then you're continually exposed, then you may have further central nervous system damage.
You'd be a mad hatter.
You'd be a mad hatter, certainly. Yes, you will. Methemoglobinemia. It's the lack of a proper hemoglobin molecule.
But wasn't that like a medication?
Oh, silver nitrate. That got took, yeah. Which would accumulate here. Yeah. Some stuff we can excrete, other stuff we cannot. So.
And explain like a fatty liver. Like what, I heard that like if you take certain medications or something, it can cause you to have like a fatty liver.
You can store fat here as well, so if there's a lot of fat being filtered through the liver, it stores it in the hepatocytes too, and it makes it look something like this. You can see the second one there is kind of a yellowish color, so it just can store excess fat. So yeah, medications can do that. Diet can do it. If somebody has, like, say, a normal 2,000-calorie diet, and then they say, I'm going to go on a mass diet and cut the calories to 500, then your liver stores fat, and that can cause fatty liver syndrome, too.
But you can repair that. Things that you can do, like if you've got fatty liver,
I think if it's medically induced, like, you know, some medicines that someone takes, maybe not so much. But like I always think about the game show Survivor, where people go and they have like a massive cut in calories. I imagine when they come home and restore to a normal diet, that's probably reversible. Yeah.
One on the right looks like a steak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it covers alcohol. So do they just say that it's pickled liver?
Basically, yeah.
That's
yeah. It is a pickled liver. Yeah. So if you've got something like alcohol or medications that travel through the liver, these hepatocytes around these areas of blood flow can actually become damaged by the kinds of chemicals they store. So if it's constantly medication or constantly alcohol, then those cells become hardened and are not able to regenerate, and so that's how we get cirrhosis.
So is there a way to like my husband's on a lot of medications, and he has high liver enzymes, and they say that he has fatty liver. So is there something to like prevent that from happening, even if it's taking the medications or like switching medications?
Probably switching medications would be the only thing to prevent further damage if those medications are causing the damage in the first place. Yeah. Which is unfortunate for medications to do that.
Yeah. There's all this side effect with him.
What's that?
Is it all medication has side effects?
They all do, right? There's a pro and a con of everything. Yeah.
What the side effects being the relationship was like.
Yeah.
That looks painful.
Let me go back and hit liver functions. They're down there near the bottom of your page. Oh, let's go one more time through hepatic coral. I got so obsessed with the central vein, hepatic vein, we didn't get all the way through that. Okay, so we got the blood flow from the superior mesenteric, inferior mesenteric vein into the hepatic portal vein. We take that blood flow through these sinusoids that we were looking at. That blood flow then joins a central vein in the middle. And from the central veins, and there's more than one of these central veins, by the way, we now join up with the exit route. So what veins take us out of the liver?
Hepatic.
Yeah. So back out to the big picture, hepatic veins take you out, and they link up to the IVC. And so all this is a detour. It gives the liver an opportunity to store items that may be needed, such as, say, sugars that we want to store, or even toxins that we want to remove from blood circulation. Okay, so you'll want to know, especially hepatic portal vein takes you into the liver, hepatic vein takes you out. And I don't believe that's actually written out in order for you on the test to pick a correct flow pathway. You just want to be familiar with this is a detour through the liver. Okay. Do y'all have any questions on that hepatic portal circulation? Okay. And then finally down there at the bottom of the page, liver functions, where we were heading. We know that bile production occurs here. And let's take a look at what's found in bile. There you go, thank you. Pigments in there makes our bile what color?
Yellow-green,
right. In fact, bile comes from components of hemoglobin. And of course, bile is the reason that our feces turn a brown color. So a lot of connections here. The salts and the phospholipids are actually the active portions of bile that help us with emulsification. So what is emulsification? Yeah, big globs of fat into smaller globs, good. And then finally, we've got cholesterol, triglycerides, and electrolytes in bile, but the main action comes from those bile salts and those other kind of components like phospholipids. Okay. On the top of the next page, we know that the liver also stores glucose as glycogen under the direction of which hormone?
Insulin.
Good. Something very important the liver does, it makes plasma proteins, things like albumin, for instance. What type of pressure, osmotic or hydrostatic, depends on those proteins?
Osmotic.
Osmotic, good. So people who have liver problems or liver inflammation will then have problems maintaining blood osmotic pressure. So what do we often see if you have low osmotic pressure?
Edema,
yeah. So where's the fluid accumulating?
In the interstitial
space, right. So liver problems that cause decreased plasma protein production cause decreased osmotic pressure and swelling. So we know that the liver is a detoxification center for alcohol, medications, drugs. Anything you put in your mouth hits the bloodstream and, of course, travels from the intestines through the liver for cleansing. And finally, a component of bile is broken down here. It's called bilirubin. Bilirubin should be broken down by your liver and excreted throughout your waste products. But unfortunately, if bilirubin gets into your bloodstream, it can make you turn a certain color.
Yellow.
Yep, sure can. So we want to make sure that bilirubin is broken down and removed out of your body, not built up in the bloodstream. Okay. Just a few liver disorders there. Hepatitis is one. What technically is going on with hepatitis?
Inflammation,
right. What can be some of the causes of inflammation? Bacteria, yep, drugs, alcohol, they can be viral in nature, and of course, you can even get little worms that can cause liver inflammation. So there's a lot of underlying reasons here for liver inflammation.
information.
A lot of these symptoms may appear familiar. You know, we expect to see jaundicing when there's liver problems, but we don't necessarily expect to connect breast development in males back with liver conditions. Nor do we expect to see a generalized itching, which is a liver issue. My aunt had cancer about 20 years ago, and she actually had liver cancer and didn't realize it, and the symptom that was giving it away was itching. She had constant itching. She went to a dermatologist. They gave her cream after cream after cream, and then finally somebody else made the connection and did a blood test and said, ah, you don't have dermatological issues. You've got liver cancer. So, yeah, so that's certainly something to pay attention to. If you've got itching, that points back to liver inflammation. Not necessarily cancer, but that could be what's going on there. I also want to mention the color of urine and stool when you've got liver inflammation. The dark colored urine and the clay colored stools, I mean the color of the walls here, are basically warning signs that bile is not being excreted into the feces. Rather, it's backing up into the bloodstream, and that's what gives us a dark-colored urine. So yet another warning sign pointing back at the liver. I'm going to let you guys read these slides if you'd like to have them. There's information in here about hepatitis, viral. You know, you've got B virus and C virus, all sorts of information here for you. Even more information here if you'd like to read about it. Some of these we can receive vaccinations against, others, you know, not. But nonetheless, these can cause liver inflammation. And like with any virus that we get, there are ours to keep for our lifetime. We just have to hope that the inflammation subsides after the infection is gone. But nonetheless, the virus that we get is always ours to keep. We talked about cirrhosis. So, you know, the liver stores toxins, waste products. And so if there's a lot of toxins or waste, then we can cause this hardening of the liver tissue, and that's what we call cirrhosis.
Didn't they find a cure or something for hepatitis C?
Sure did, yeah. You probably see all those billboards around town, you know, get checked.
You're a baby boomer.
Yeah. Fluid. Wow. I bet he was glad to get that fluid off.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure. I bet he couldn't breathe.
It was very difficult for him.
Yeah. We've kind of talked about the gallbladder already. Its only job is to be a storage sac for what?
Bile.
Yeah. And so every time bile is stored there, it's dehydrated. And that's where we run into problems, is every time you dehydrate it, you remove water, and you leave the crystals of cholesterol, triglycerides, salts to play around by themselves. And when they do that, they can form stones. So that's how we tend to get gallstones, when those crystals hang out and form groups together. Now, if you're not digesting food, bile may be produced by the liver, and it may in fact back up into a cystic duct for storage in your gallbladder. That should be your blank. Bile can back up that cystic duct. But of course, if you're digesting, then we're going to see bile being produced by the liver. It can be ejected from the liver and the gallbladder into the small intestine. So, you know, basically we're looking at the gallbladder ejecting its contents when there are fats present in the small intestine. Left lobe, you're right, and cystic duct is your other blank there. Right lobe, should be right lobe. Yep. Just wanted to mention that people can have gallstones. They can walk around with them for years, have no problems from them. Where we start to see problems is when those stones are ejected from the cystic duct. They can cause a blockage there. They can further cause a blockage if those stones make it down to the common bile duct. Now bile has no way to get to the small intestine. And worse yet, if we look at this picture, bile can actually be blocked if you have a stone reach all the way down here to this little ampulla. not only are you blocking the conduit of bile, but what else are you also blocking?
Pancreatic.
Yeah, pancreatic juices cannot escape. So people may in fact have pancreatitis if the gallstones make it that far in this pathway. So, hey, we did it. We are done. That is it for this chapter. We'll cover metabolism on Tuesday and do just a little bit of review at the end of class.